automation to taxation, covering inflation, temptation, high expectations, and that dreaded stagnation. We bring to you Hit Nation.
Hey everyone, and welcome to episode 9 of Hip Nation. Today we are talking about side hustles, which is a very favorite topic of mine, but also I'm sure a lot of you, most people have side hustles these days. So my name is Sarah.
And I am Shay.
And today we have one of our very dear friends. His name is Daryl Richards. And that was like the least exciting intro to one of the best human beings that we know. This is the same Daryl that you guys have all heard us talking about literally every single episode. He's very well known in our community here in Penticton, but also just a damn good human being. And I'll pass it over to you, Daryl. Tell us about you and who you are.
Well, thanks for that wonderful intro. I'm honored to be here. It's kind of an interesting thing you guys are doing, and I'm just grateful for the opportunity to come in and share a little bit about who I am, what I do, and maybe put a bit of a voice and a face to the drops that you guys always seem to wrangle me into on your podcasts. I get mentioned more than I'd like sometimes, but it's a perfect gig for me because I got an excellent face for radio. So.
That's excellent.
Speaking of radio, you were just telling us before we started about some past radio experience that you've had. Once you said it, I was like, oh, yeah, that makes sense because you have the voice for it for sure. And not only radio, you're a good looking dude, Daryl. You can do TV anytime.
Yeah, I am pretty hot. There's no doubt. Yeah, no, I've done a bit of radio. I've done a pilot public speaking. I've been honored enough to do some pretty cool TV stuff, even with some celebrities throughout the years, which is kind of neat. So it makes it very comfortable for me when I do, just shooting from the hip videos around my shop. When I'm advertising something, I'm very comfortable in that element. So I'm a firm believer, too. When I do my videos, I don't edit them. If I screw up, I just post it out there for people to see. I'm human. Yep. So I think that it gives people an idea of how real you are. If you can make a mistake on your video or stumble and go, oops, and carry on. So, I like raw. I don't like things to be too polished.
Yeah, we have that same theory here too,
and I think that's the fantastic thing about the podcast platform is it doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be polished.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It doesn't need to be.
It's not a radio ad.
Yeah, exactly. It's not a radio ad. It's not an episode of Yellowstone. Like it doesn't need to be. It doesn't need to be perfect.
I think we're all fans of Yellowstone in this room. Although you were saying you thought season 2 kind of sucked. So
no, 4. No, season 4 now.
Season 4.
I'm really struggling with season 4. Sorry, Yellowstone fans out there. I'm a Yellowstone fan, but oh my God, I just want to scream at my TV like the Oilers from a few years ago. Man, I was throwing stuff at my TV.
So what's the struggle? The drawback from it? You just don't like how it's changed or shifted or what?
Yeah. The whole season this year is totally different than the first 3 seasons. There's just not enough going on.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot less killing so far, but it's not the same as, it doesn't have the same feel. Like, I wonder if maybe they changed writers or something happened in there.
Oh,
Yeah. Well, I don't know, but I am so excited to like jump right into this because I am just there's so many questions that I have for you. Obviously, before the podcast started, I was just already getting into it, and it's like, stop it, this is good information. So, so if we can kick it right off, like, you have a lot of self esteem, and you're a self advocate, and you promote yourself a lot. Were you born this way? Did you just come into the world like, hey, I'm Daryl Richards, I've arrived?
I've arrived.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's I've always had a lot of confidence. And I think early on, possibly some of that confidence was out of necessity. There was, you know, you get pushed around or, you know, I was a pretty small kid, you know, until when I graduated high school, I was 155 pounds. And I really hadn't hit a growth spurt. So I was always kind of a little smaller. You know, my brother's 6'3", 300 pounds. So he's, a menacing, powerful man. So, you know, for me to be the smaller, younger brother, or the smaller, older brother, I guess, it was weird. So it was, some of it was necessity. But I think I just always had confidence in everything I did. So if it was public speaking, if it was a new job, if it was a task that I was given, I had confidence in my abilities fairly early on, and I think that was, you know, it started out maybe as necessity, but it just became a part of my life. And, you know, for a long time, I was maybe overconfident. So it came off brash. It came off the wrong way. And as I got older and I figured out how to be more humble, then my confidence was more inspiring to people, I think, than if you're just that brash, hey, look at me, I'm handsome, you know, like my Levi 501s are tight. And, you know, I'm the guy. And, yes. And you know what I mean? Like it sort of was the wrong, it was the wrong thing.
Yeah.
And I think as I figured out how to be humble, it certainly helped. And I think it's inspired a lot of people. A lot of people comment on it, you know, oh, you can go into a room and you can, you can kind of take control of a bit of your environment. And,
yeah.
And it's not this overconfident, hey, look at me sort of thing.
No.
It's more of a, I'm trying to get to know people. I'm trying to show people who I am, but I'm also trying to inspire people to come along.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's always a thing where, you know, I tell people, you know, if you put me in a room with a microphone and there's 10 people, okay, I can handle that. But if you give me 1,000 people, it's going to be a party. It's going to be a performance.
Yeah.
Because it just seems like I can feed off that energy and I want to get people involved. So it's just always been something I've been comfortable with is being confident for sure.
Have you ever done the DISC personality assessment?
I believe I did, yeah.
And he was a solid D.
Well, I was going to say probably an I, like
oh,
the influencer.
Oh, 100% influencer, yeah.
But yeah, definitely some D.
Yeah.
Some D in the D.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I get
Daryl
man,
has
that
a
went in the ditch
many,
fast.
It always does.
Daryl has many nicknames, and one of them is D, so
yeah.
That's where I was going with that.
Well, it's just kind of funny because over the years, depending on who I was hanging out with, they all had seemed to have different nicknames for me. So, but they all kind of centered around, you know, like some guys just call me D, some guys call me Big D, some guys call me Richie Rich, some guys call me Rich. It was just kind of strange.
Yeah.
How it evolved, but
you definitely can see like what you're talking about, your how you've changed your perspective in how you approach people with your self-confidence, and people can feed off of that. Like mm-hmm. I know, like especially when you don't have a lot of confidence and you're around somebody that does, you have two choices. One, you can choose to shrink away and not partake in that. Mm-hmm. But the way that you approach it, when people come around you and they don't have a lot of self-esteem, I know personally that you start feeding off of it and you're like, fuck yes. As soon as I start like getting out there and getting lively, you mm-hmm. react and you reciprocate that and you feel a lot more confident. So I think that really, I've noticed that people are drawn to that.
Mm-hmm.
They're drawn to that center of attention. Like we've gone to a few events, the 81st Gala for the Junior Chamber International and the Business Excellence Awards for the Chamber of Commerce here in Penticton. And fuck, Daryl steals the show. Like you literally, are you sitting? It was like dead quiet. And I like come up on like I call it the Megatron, but it's just like this screen up at the top, which I wasn't expecting. And I'm like, I hate public awareness. And Daryl's like, oh, you're a superstar. I'm like, fuck you, Daryl. Like, it is quiet in that auditorium, but I can hear it. But he's like, you can sense it. It's like, be proud of something that you do.
Oh, we were just having
or
a
where
good
you
time.
Are. Yeah, no, but it was awesome. Like, especially because, you know, Tracy going up for Total Restoration.
Certainly.
You were, yeah. It was so loud, the cheering that was coming from that section,
mm-hmm.
that you could just feel it. You wanted to be part of your party.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And your voice was very dominant in that.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I do have a bit of a loud voice.
You do.
I think the other part of being confident and trying to create that buzz is being able to read the room and read the people.
Yeah.
And I think that I do, you know, I'm not trying to brag, but I think I have a good read on people to find the people that are maybe a little bit quieter and try and bring them in to, you know, include them. And I think that, you know, that's important. I think when you have skills, you should share them. And whether it's a, you know, a legitimate skill or not, I still think you have to be able to, you know, share that experience with those people as well. Because I think what it does for somebody, that, like you say, they can either shrink away or they can grow and join that fast-moving train. I think that at least if you can recognize that and you can bring them along, that helps them too. It just brings them into the whole party.
So were you always this perceptive, or is it something you picked up along the way that you were just like, this is how I can help this situation. This is how I can help these people. Like,
you know what? I think that I've always been fairly perceptive. I think the challenge for me was figuring out how to not overwhelm people, because you can overwhelm people pretty quickly with a loud personality and, turn them off. So I think that, you know, being able to just rein that back a little bit until they get comfortable with, you know, how big maybe your personality is, and not just me, like other people with big personalities. I think it's something you have to figure out, because you can overwhelm them so quickly. Yeah. It's also a good thing to have at times, and some of the jobs I've had, where you have to overwhelm people because they will try and push you around and bully you. And if you can control that situation a little bit with your personality, it's not such a bad thing. But like I say, it can also go the other way, and it can be a very, you know, devastating thing to have.
So is there like tools that people, because the business is exactly what I was thinking about. That's kind of where I was going next. But it's like, for someone that's timid and a little bit like scared to jump off that bridge of like approaching a conversation and having control or involvement in it, when it comes to business, it is so easy to get pushed around.
Certainly.
And it is like, do you have tools or skills that you can advise people to use in business dealings that will create confidence in their approach, or when they're dealing with contracts, or when they want to approach for new business? Is there skills that they can use or take into those conversations?
Honestly, I think education isn't such a bad thing. You know, I was a very strong negotiator most of my life. Honestly, as far back as I can remember, negotiating skills. I think there's a fine line there too between negotiating and manipulating. So I think there's some pitfalls there if you don't know how to control that. But even as a salesman, I took sales courses to try and figure out, you know, more tactful ways to negotiate and deal with people with different personalities. Because, you know, you go in to try and sell something, you overwhelm them, you turn them off, you don't get the sale. So, you know, education is key, I think. But honestly, for me, I had so many opportunities growing up. You know, I've got a family that's very community involved, a family that is very aware. So, you know, they taught me early on to, you know, go into a room, you know, observe, act a certain way. And then once you get a read on the room, then you can start to bring your personality out or find where you're going to move. And so for me, you know, having a family with that sort of awareness to teach their kids these skills and basic skills, and just watching, you know, mom and dad, my grandparents, and, you know, negotiate and deal with their farm and how they tried to progress their farm. You know, you just pick that stuff up too. And I think a lot of kids don't have those opportunities now because both parents work. You know, they don't get a lot of that interaction. And for me, you know, you grew up on a family farm, you work together, you live together, you holiday together, you do everything together. And as long as you've got a good foundation in a family, that's fantastic. So I was pretty fortunate. I have zero complaints about how I grew up, where I grew up geographically, you know, the time. I mean, being born in the 70s and really growing up in the 80s and the early 90s was, I mean, it was just a fantastic time. I mean, everything was cool about that time. Music, cars, you know.
Yeah, especially cars. Not in the 80s.
Yeah, well, you know, what was going on at the time? I mean, everybody says the 50s were, you know, and the 60s and 70s were the time. But man, I just couldn't imagine growing up in a different time because there was just so much cool stuff. Mm-hmm. It was just a great time to be alive. And I mean, you know, we went through a lot of ups and downs in those times, a lot of economic depression. And, you know, so we didn't grow up with a lot. So you just had to make do. You had to entertain yourself. And
it's I would imagine that if you're growing up with not a lot, that being community minded is also not easy, because when you don't have a lot to give and you're still giving, like that just says so much about you and your parents and family. Yeah. That's an incredible, incredible trait.
Well, you know what was, you know, what's so interesting about that is, you know, you grow up and you think you know your parents because you're with them all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so in 2016, my mom and dad won Farm Family of the Year, which a lot of people are like, what? What does that even mean? You know, and I even really didn't know what it meant at the time, but they got nominated, they won, and then they have this massive gala to, you know, to present them with all their awards and list their accomplishments. And so we get to this thing, and I mean, there's elected officials, there's past winners of the Farm Family of the Year, you know, at the opening of the bull sale. And I know this sounds corny to lots of city people, but there's a massive bull sale they do at this event. And we got to go up as a family and ring the bell to start the auction. Oh, that's cool. And they bring you in a horse-drawn, you know, sleigh. And it's just a whole thing. And so that evening, you know, the entire family standing up on the stage, and the member of parliament started this speech about my parents and their list of accomplishments. And I was standing way at the far end, being the oldest. I typically put everybody ahead of me, and I'll be in the back or I'll be at the end or whatever. So I'm standing way at the end, and the entire family's there. And he starts listing the accomplishments that my parents had done over the 35 years. And there's a picture of me, and I'm literally like leaning outside the line of people, looking at my parents like I didn't know who they were. Wow. Because I didn't realize how much community involvement they had. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize what they had dedicated their lives to at that point. And it was just this moment of pride, because I had no idea that they had done all this stff to help an industry that is under fire, is looked down upon at times, but yet we all go eat. You know, without their contribution to farming, number one, I don't know what I'd be doing. But I mean, where would the world be if we didn't have responsible farmers like that family? And I mean, even to today, you know, they don't take their foot off the gas. My parents have retired. My brother has taken over, and he's been farming for 25 years. Wow. You know, he started just out of high school when he was in college getting his ag degree. He started farming. And I mean, he still carries on that tradition of community involvement. Mm-hmm. They just donated, he had won an opportunity to get this $2,500 bursary for himself for some project. And so he went to the seed company that had this bursary, and he said, I'll tell you what, I don't want the $2,500. He said, you give me the equivalent in seed, I'll donate the land, we'll plant this crop. They got a couple of other seed companies involved to cover fertilizer and spray. He donated his time, his equipment, his land. Mm-hmm. They seeded this crop. They harvested this crop this fall, and they sold that crop, and they donated that. They took that $2,500 and they turned it into a $50,000 donation to an arena project in the hamlet of 250 people that we grew up in.
Yeah.
So that they could put that money towards the hamlet. And this is the second year they've done the project. And they'll continue to do it until the arena is built. So their contribution continually in their community is huge. So that's kind of what we do, because you help people when you have more, and you hope they help you when you have less. Yeah. And so that's my involvement in the community here. You know, I try and you know, donate my time and do outreach and various other things.
Well, and you do a very good job of surrounding yourself with like-minded people.
Yeah.
I think you have to.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to get sucked into the wrong circle if you don't.
100%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So enough about me. This is all about you.
Yeah.
No, but this is like that farm lifestyle, you know, I've talked about it before, but that's what my hubby and I are trying to get into. But when you talk about the need for that, how important those industries are and how... This is amazing to me to see your family legacy carrying on, because a lot of them are actually letting go and the government's trying to create incentives to get people back into those fields.
It's a hard business.
100%.
It's not a business you get into and you're going to get rich. Like my parents farmed for 35 years before they started buying new vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, that's a massive commitment.
You give up what material things you want in your life in order to have a lifestyle.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's a lifestyle, honestly. Yeah. Yeah. You know, and the funny thing about farms, like where I grew up, grain, beef, bison, obviously sheep and chickens and all the things that go along with, you know, a large family farm, because you typically, the way I was raised is you feed yourself off the farm. So our gardens were massive. I mean, we used to plant 150 hills of potatoes and, you know, that's how we survived the winters. We had our own food. So, you know, it is a lifestyle, and it is a catalyst for eventually being a landowner, which is weird because I never saw that as a kid. You know, I just saw mom and dad struggle. And, you know, when we were done school, we had chores. When Saturday morning rolled around, you got up at 7, you went and picked rocks. There was always something to do, and it was just sacrifice, sacrifice, sacrifice. Well, you know, after 35 or 40 years of farming, my parents are some of the largest landowners in our area. Mm-hmm. And like Dad said, I never imagined that those struggles would lead to being one of the largest landowners in the area. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my brother is a well-respected farmer. He basically consults half a dozen other farms on seeding and, you know, how they should seed depths, fertilizer amounts, crop rotations. Wow. You know, he's an extremely intelligent man, but that's his life too. I mean, he got an ag degree, so it made him a better farmer, so that he understood the science behind, you know, ag. It's not just about tilling the land, throwing some seed in it, and harvesting, hoping you can harvest it in the fall.
Yeah.
You know, it's a science.
It's kind of like, I mean,
and being a steward of the land.
Yeah.
Like my family firmly believes that land is there for them to look after, you know, and that is, you know, when they come under fire because activists think that they're destroying the world.
Yeah.
They should go out and take a crop tour and really understand what they do.
It's true.
They look after, they are stewards of the land. And that is the way most farmers act, because if you destroy your land, you don't have a farm.
Yeah.
And so people don't understand that they've got to look after that.
I had a client in yesterday talking to me about, so he's a business owner, and he was telling me about how his wife is kind of very like instant gratification type person.
Mm-hmm. I think most people are now.
For sure. Myself included.
Mm-hmm.
So as he grows his business, of course, very similar to the farming business, you're putting your money that you should be bringing home or would like to bring home back into the equipment and the things that you need to grow the business.
Right.
So basically what he was saying was like his wife isn't seeing any more money coming in.
Yeah.
Yep.
And he's saying, well, just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not happening. So
that's right.
As you're talking about the farm and this massive 35-year commitment, that's a long fucking time to go without.
It is a lifelong commitment. It certainly is. And even after retirement, you never get out of it.
Yeah.
My parents are retired. My dad works just as hard now as he did when he owned the farm. So
is he working on the farm still?
Yeah, he works for my brother.
But that keeps them moving, and that's like...
And that's Dad's life. That's been his entire life. That farm is his... Yeah. His shrine to what he's accomplished, right, is the success of that farm.
That's
so,
amazing.
Yeah, I mean, my brother is fifth generation, I believe.
Wow.
His daughters may even take, he's got three daughters, and one of them has expressed an interest in the farm.
That's
so
awesome.
He may have a daughter to take over his farm.
That's
so
awesome.
You just never know what's going to happen. You never know where the end of the farm is. You know, and, you know, for me right now, this is a great segue into the side hustle.
Yeah.
And I've got a story about that. So I recognize the side hustle midlife, I would say. When my folks started farming, it was out of necessity. I come from a blended family, so my dad was married to another woman, had my brother. My mom was married to another man, had myself and my sister. They got married and had another daughter, so I've got a brother and two sisters. Cool thing for me was when they got together and we moved out to the farm, I had a brother that was the same age, so really we're best buddies.
Aww.
So it was kind of interesting because we used to mess with people all the time. They'd be like, oh, you guys are brothers? We were always in the same grade, same hockey teams, etc. So people would be like, oh, what's the age difference? And we'd be like, 9 months. And they were like, whoa. The next words out of their mouth would be like, are you guys Mennonite?
No.
Oh, yeah.
There you go.
So, I mean, that's always the joke back home, right, is you know, Mennonites get after it. They need that labor force. So they push the dock out of the way to get back in there and have another kid, right? So, but the side hustle part. So my folks, when we moved out to the farm, Dad had just finished building a massive split level home, 3,600 square feet. He had a great job with a dealership in Grand Prairie, and he lost his job in 1980. As did a lot of people. I mean, it was a massive economic crash. It was a massive economic crisis. And so his dad said to him, you should come and farm with me. So Dad said, okay. So he went farming and he didn't make any money. It was just money in, money in, money in. So my dad and my mom decided it was time for a side hustle. My mom used to make all our clothes and stuff. So my mom was a seamstress. She still is to this day. She's got a 1400 square foot craft room. And it's got quilting machines and her painting easels. My mom is extremely artistic, but she started making our clothes. So a lot of the clothes we wore growing up, mom made. So it was weird because the other kids were wearing like Ikea jeans. And we were wearing like corduroy pants that mom made.
Yep.
But really, at the end of the day, how cool is that? I had custom clothes when I was like seven years old. I was like, psh, you guys can go buy your stuff at Kmart, man. I got custom.
Is that how you actually felt at the time?
We didn't care. Honestly, I didn't care that my clothes were made. It really didn't make a difference to me.
Yeah.
You know, there was a few kids at school that their parents had the money and they had the fancy shoes and the new Air Jordans and whatever. And we just didn't. And it was the way it was. But mom's side hustle was she started a fabric store rurally. So a lot of the surrounding ladies would come and they'd buy fabric and, you know, thread and all the things they needed to make clothes for their kids or repair things and whatever. So my dad did a couple of winters at the local hockey rink where he looked after the ice and the plant and he did that. But then he had an opportunity to really get into the side hustle that pushed them over the edge and made the farm, made it so that it worked well with the farm. So my dad started he took a contract and started working for a clothing company out of Edmonton called Marv Holland Industries. And Marv himself started about the same time as Sun Ice, the same way as Sun Ice. They knew each other. Yeah. Sun Ice was in Calgary working out of their basement. Marv was in Edmonton working out of his basement, and then pretty soon Sun Ice had a factory, pretty soon Marv Holland had a factory, and they were both based in Calgary and Edmonton. So my dad started working for Marv, and Marv was a real family man, real gentleman, just a great entrepreneur, and it worked with my dad's schedule. My dad could farm all summer, and then when winter would roll around, my dad would hit the road, and so this was probably mid-80s. And so Dad would hit the road and he would go around to service stations, all these sort of commercial type businesses, and he would do their uniforms.
Mm.
So if you were ever traveling in northern BC from the mid 80s to the mid 90s and you went to a Chevron station, their clothes, my dad sold them.
That's cool.
And so he would spend the winters on the road and he would sell commercial clothing and he would fax, Yes, I said fax. With thermal paper.
What?
And my dad would fax the orders from wherever he was. His area was massive. He was from White Court, Alberta, all the way to the Queen Charlotte Islands, to the Northwest wow. Territories, and down to like Grand Cache. So his area was massive. So he would just be on the road. He would fax mom the orders. Mom would fill the orders, fax them to Marv Holland and Edmonton. They would get the garments ready. They would ship them out. Yeah. And so my mom and dad did that for 12, 15 years. Yeah. And it worked with his schedule. Dad could farm in the summer. He'd sell in the winter. And that was his side hustle.
Yeah.
So when I was in high school, I was probably 17 or 18. He finally sold his business, his clothing contract, mm-hmm. to a gentleman. And then they actually went farming full time. And that was, so the farm never made money for so long that dad needed a side hustle to put money back into the farm and make sure that we could eat. We had a roof over our head. Yeah. They could buy the farm because we just lived on an acreage and we would have to drive to the farm where my grandparents were, and that was where the farm was based. So they finally, there was a neighboring farm that was, they were retiring, and it was actually my grade 3 teacher. So it was kind of cool. So they bought that farm, and that was the start of them farming full time. And he finally got rid of the side hustle. Yeah. And since then, they've never side hustled. It's been farm for them.
Yeah.
So I was in my 20s, and dad and I were riding the combine or something. I stopped in to visit because I didn't farm. And, you know, he said if it hadn't have been for Marv and him being nice enough to work around my schedule, the farm would have never survived.
Wow.
And so, you know, that's when I started thinking side hustle. You need a side hustle that works with your current schedule. And if it evolves into a business where you can do it full time, great. And my dad could have made a great living just selling for Marv Holland. You know, I remember in the late 80s, I remember him and mom talking about the best year they had. And we're talking late 80s. They had done over $100,000. But that money had to go into the farm, yeah, because yeah. that was the bigger vision for my parents, was the family farm, continuing on the family farm. And so I realized in my 20s, the side hustle is something that can help you with lifestyle, can help you move your business ahead, can help you with your hobbies, you know, because then you don't have to draw from the money that pays your bills.
So speaking of the side hustle, for those people that are listening and don't know you, what is your main source of income? And then what are your side hustles?
So fortunately for me, I get to do something that I really enjoy. I build homes. And typically we build homes on spec. So we use our own cash. We build a home. We sell it. And so I manage those crews. My part of the job is I manage those crews. I try and get the paperwork into my partners as best I can, because I do have two partners in the business. One of them is a very silent partner, and then the loudest partner we have is my parents.
Really?
Yeah, that's my cool. My parents are very generous with us kids. They gave my brother the opportunity to farm, and they helped him along, and it led to them being able to retire because my brother could buy them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so my parents then transitioned to my opportunity, which is, okay, we're going to help you with your business. So they are my financial partners. And they're great to have because, you know, my dad loves money, and this is a way for him to, in his retirement,
yeah.
to see some money moving around and to provide a future for me. So
that's amazing.
Yeah, they're pretty cool that way. That's they're pretty rad, but they're young. My parents are 65 and 68. So they're
wow,
not, they're not
they
even,
are young.
Yeah, they're not even that old, right? So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Huh.
And I mean, that says something. I mean, I'm 46, so my parents are,
they got at it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know what?
Doing the math right now.
You know, I'm 46. I got a 23-year-old and a 21-year-old. So, I mean, wow. You know, it's...
Yeah,
that's, you know, get it done and out of the way so you can enjoy right? your later years.
Yeah.
But I also didn't want to be too old with kids, so I can enjoy time with them and go play
that.
The sports with them and do the things. So.
For sure.
I keep saying that every kid that I had, I did the math of when they were going to move out of the house.
yeah, no kidding.
yeah,
so that's what I do to pay the day-to-day. And then fortunately for me, I have a lot of passions that came from growing up on a farm. I'm very mechanical. I'm a welder fabricator by trade. I have been for 25 plus years.
Yeah.
So I have a little side hustle called Sinister Speed Co. And I get to do some pretty cool stuff. I get to build motorcycles. I get to work on motorcycles. I get to do suspension. You know, so being an avid Harley rider myself, my side hustle helps me to pursue that passion and have that in my life at very little expense from my day-to-day job. So really my side hustle was born out of trying to support my extremely expensive riding habits.
Excellent.
And it can be expensive. It doesn't have to be, but it can be. And, you know, I'm fortunate that way. You know, I got to build my own personal bike this year, which I'm super proud of. And, I love the expression that people give me when they either see it or hear it. It's either total joy or complete disgust, because it is just the most obnoxious thing on the planet.
But you have to tell people what you call it.
So I bought this old 71 Harley Davidson Shovelhead FXE Super Glide back in the spring, and the vision for it was to do a garage build so that people could see that you don't have to go spend $100,000 building a custom motorcycle. You can do it in your garage with basic hand tools. I didn't want to do anything fancy or over the top, but it was a little patina. It had some scratches on it and a bit of rust and stuff. So my vision for that bike was to keep it patinaed, keep it old looking. Mm-hmm. And so the name of the bike was born out of that, because it's a shovel head and it looks like shit. I named it the old shit shovel, and it's kind of got a personality of its own.
It does.
People are really drawn to it.
Yeah. Well, it's different, right?
It
doesn't look like any other bike out there.
Yeah.
And it's probably louder than most things in any city setting.
I have been beside CF18s when they take off, and this bike is very close to that. It's obnoxious.
I don't doubt that. It's very, I don't know how you ride it without like ear protection.
Hey, the sound is behind me, man. So the faster I go, the further away the sound gets in my mind. So it's just an extension of me. It's an extension of what my abilities are. Mm-hmm. From growing up on a farm, we had to be carpenters. We had to be cooks. We had to be butchers. We had to be hunter gatherers. We had to be mechanics. We had to be welders. We had to be all this stuff. And so that bike really is skills that I just grew up.
But even like your side hustle there, like I've done a ton of research to this point about farm living, and and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the basic things that seems to be like repeated over and over again is everything that you have either needs to make money or you need to have money to cover that.
That's correct.
So you can't just have a constant expense.
Yeah.
And that's what I hear from you, is you're like, you know, this is my hobby. This is what I want to do. But here's my side hustle to kind of like take. It's not taking from your core money.
No. Well, and that's right. And I think that that's where you get into the pitfalls of a side hustle. You have to recognize what a side hustle is versus a hobby. Mm-hmm. Because a side hustle technically should sustain itself or make some form of income. Mm-hmm. A hobby is something you're going to dump money into, and it eats up time and it doesn't pay you back.
Yeah.
And so it's great to have hobbies. Trust me, I have many. Mm-hmm. But I think to truly be a side hustle is something that should make you money. But there's also pitfalls in side hustles, because your main source of income is your job. And let's just say you have a 9-to-5 job. Mm-hmm. But then all of a sudden your side hustle cuts into, oh, I need a couple hours off today because I've got to go play with my side hustle. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a pitfall. It's taken away from your job. So is it paying dividends that are worth your time? And at that point, then when does your side hustle just become your hustle? Mm-hmm. And so really, you know, yeah, Sinister is my side hustle. It really is more my passion. It keeps me involved in my riding community. It keeps me in, it gives me a purpose to bust into a group of guys and talk. And
something really unique that you've done with your side hustle is you've given it a side hustle of its own. In your clothing line.
Yeah.
Or eventually.
Yeah. And you know what? I just always really wanted to have something cool that was signature me. Mm-hmm. And so I think that the clothing is kind of signature me. You know, it's got an edge to it, but not too much of an edge. It's on the church side of edge.
Well,
you know, and
I don't know, this sleeve on my hoodie might say different.
But that's and that honestly was as far as we wanted to go with that brand. And I mean, you know, I get a ton of compliments on the way the brand looks, mm-hmm. and that is mostly due to your incredible vision for being able to read what I wanted. You know, the skull really is the signature that everybody comments on, and it's like, well, that was Sarah.
Yeah. Well, it was you. It was just my hands doing the work.
Right. But it was, you know what, I think that when you, you know, you talk about the people that you need to be involved with and the people that are going to get your vision and stuff, mm-hmm. You have to pick the right people so that they understand what you want.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we'll call it the biker lifestyle. I think a lot of people get confused with the biker lifestyle. They think that you can just be a drunken hooligan and do all this crazy stuff, and that's the biker lifestyle. And I just feel like it gets misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. The biker lifestyle is the passion, obviously, for the iron and the open road and stuff, but it's the camaraderie, it's the brotherhood, it's the ability to take that camaraderie and brotherhood and do amazing things in your community.
Mm-hmm.
Volunteer your time. You know, one of the greatest things I've ever been a part of, well, there's a few of them in the riding community, but like Peter's son's birthday. I mean, just the sheer glee on his face when we rolled up with 35 bikes. And I mean, he was beside himself and Peter was crying. I mean, it was a very emotional thing, right?
Was that Peter Verge?
Yeah. Cool. And when we went to Carter's birthday a couple of years ago, because it was COVID, so we were supposed to do a drive-by. Well, it turned into an all-out bike show.
That's
we took over the street, and we didn't care who was coming down the street.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, so I think that people get a misconception about bikers. And I think that for most bikers are very community-minded people.
Yes.
Because it's a catalyst.
Yeah.
It's something that, whether you don't think bikes are cool or not, when you see 50 bikes roll into a parking lot and everybody, you know, they're loud and everybody's getting off and they're shiny and they're all those things, if you don't like bikes, you're going to look.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, that's a catalyst for us to get our foot in the door a lot of times to do cool events where we can show people who we really are.
And your community is huge. Like
our community is everything.
Up north, I have some friends that are, you know, that were actually getting into the biker community,
mm-hmm.
and they were, I didn't realize this from an outward perspective. I didn't realize what the community aspect was until he's like, no, like when I'm learning how to ride with a group, it's different than riding solo.
That's right.
And, you know, they teach you. They're there to help you.
Yep.
And they're going to show you how to ride properly and the respect you show.
Yep.
And it's not what they show on, you know, TV. It actually is. They're there to teach you and guide you.
Yep.
And as a community, they're there to support one another, business
yep.
and anything else,
yeah.
which is pretty amazing. It's not what I thought it was.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's, you know, it's not Sons of Anarchy.
No, exactly. That's exactly what I was referencing, but.
Yeah.
And
I think it's a lifestyle. It has to be in you. You have to want to live that because, you know, the freedom that we'll call it a hobby provides, a lot of it is very therapeutic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm having a bad day, I can get on either one of my bikes and I will have the biggest smile on my face that you'll see me with ever because it's just, there's something about it that is just so therapeutic. And when you can do it with your partner, when you can do it with a group of friends, when you can do it with a group of people you've never met before, it's amazing. You'll rarely see a group of riders meet another group of riders and not wave.
Mm-hmm.
Some guys aren't wavers because you're not riding a Harley or you're whatever, or they just don't feel it safe, and that's fine. But there is, I can pull into any parking lot in the summertime, there'll be 10 bikes, and I will guarantee there'll be a conversation at some point.
Speaking of pulling into parking lots with a bike, remember you showed me a picture of you, I think you went on a bike ride this summer somewhere, and didn't you meet up with, I forget his name from that TV show that's on, is it on Discovery? What was that guy's name?
Oh, yeah. One of the fellows from Rest Valley. I've run into those guys a few times. No, I wasn't on a ride. I was actually, it was kind of funny because I was at Princess Auto picking up a lift. And I went around back to pick the lift up. And his name is just escaping me right now. But I pulled back there, and he was standing there. And so it's just an instant conversation because, you know, those guys are obviously on TV. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of neat that they're easy to talk to, and you run into them all over because they're all over the place here all the time trying to buy cars and whatever. But, yeah, I mean, if I hadn't had some sort of an attachment. Avery. It was Avery. Yeah, and of course he was driving that piece of junk truck that he's patched together, yeah. And it was just loaded down with junk. And he's so the same guy. He's so the same guy you see on the TV show. He's exactly that same guy.
That's cool.
He was wearing the same rubber boots, the same dirty T-shirt with the pocket in it, the same saggy jeans. It's the same dude.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
And even Mike, like I've run into Mike a couple of times, and he's the same guy.
He's awesome. Just
this tall, gangly dude with dreads, and he's like, "Yeah, man." He's just super chill awesome. And cool, and he just wants to take a picture with you, and he's just loving life.
Yeah. That's so cool.
Yeah, I run into people all the time, and it's so funny. It's just so hilarious how. You know, you're on a bike or they've seen you on Instagram or something. Like Instagram has just been the most ridiculous thing in life.
Yeah.
Because I've had people come and say, "Oh, you're Daryl with Sinister. I've seen you on Instagram. I follow you."
That's awesome.
And it's like, what? And then you feel famous for 2 seconds.
And
then you do a check and you're like, "No, I'm just that guy."
Yeah.
And they just recognize me. It's no big deal.
We've had a similar couple experiences recently with people we don't know being like, you know, we get introduced to someone and they're like, "Yeah, I know who you are from your reels."
Yeah.
I'm like, "Oh."
It's so awkward. It's like finger magnets all the way out. I'm like, "No."
Yeah.
But imagine being on a TV show like that that's got massive notoriety.
Yeah.
I mean, even one of Tracy's best friends growing up is on the show. And I mean, she made me a birthday gift back in the spring and I got to have lunch with her. And she's just a rad chick. Like, I mean, they're just regular people and you run into them all over. It's Rust Valley Restores.
Right.
And I'm not sure what they're doing with the show right now, actually, because I know Mike sold, they auctioned off all their cars and stuff, so I'm not sure what's...
Oh, I see.
I could ask Rachel, I suppose, but it's, it's kind of neat.
It's neat to see people like that. But you definitely have to be in those worlds and then pick up on it. But Penticton seems to be kind of like a hub for a lot of different celebrities and people like that.
Certainly.
Because I was telling Sarah, I freaked out the other day because I watch a lot of gold mining shows.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the workers that worked on Parker Schneble's crew lives here in Penticton. I was losing my shit.
Like, Schnobble.
Schnobble. Schneble.
Schneble was from that movie. School of Rock.
Yeah. Patrick. No, wait. Now you're confusing me. But yes, I know what you mean. But anyways, I was just losing it. I was just she lives here. And I was trying not to Sherlock the shit out of her to be like, where does she live? Because that's super creepy. But anyways, it was like, I was just fangirling out. Because I was like, you know, when you're so into those different industries and you're just like, you'd want to know how they got there.
Sure.
I'm like, how do you get there?
Sure.
So I actually, when I was Sherlocking the shit out of you, was trying to find out. So I stumbled across some articles where you had so much community involvement to get you to go on a Choppers episode? Or like, what was this about?
No, so what happened last year, so that, it's funny that you mentioned that because yesterday, I believe, was the day 1 year ago that we lost.
Yeah, I saw it on my Facebook memories.
Yeah, so what had happened was I got an email, or no, I was on Facebook one night and there was this chopper building contest. So I was like, "Oh, I'll fill out the thing. It's probably a joke," which I hope those guys from OCC hear this because honestly, that contest was a joke. But what it did, I called him out on this international podcast.
There wasn't that much silence in the background. I heard some crickets, but that's fine.
Yeah, that's okay.
It's actually international, but whatever.
Yeah, whatever. I hope they hear this because the way they handled it was a joke. It really was. So what happened was this thing came up. So I filled out the form and I didn't expect anything. But then one day I had missed an email that had gone to my junk. And so I started going through my junk emails and I had gotten selected to go into the contest. Wow. And I found out my junk email, and it started like the next day. And so I was like, holy crap. So I moved everything into my inbox. We started this contest, and I'm pacing around my house wondering what I'm going to do with this contest. Like, what do I even do? And so...
What was the contest for?
So the contest was, you know, public votes to get you to move through certain phases of this contest. And the winner would get to go to Orange County Choppers in New York and build a custom chopper with Paul Sr. Yeah. and whoever else works there in their revolving door of people that go through there. And so, yeah, I said it again. What happened was we started the contest. All of a sudden, I started getting a bunch of votes. We started doing some stuff on it. So it was social media based. So we started doing this thing. And about 3 days into the contest, I started thinking, okay, how can I use this chopper contest to benefit my community?
Of course you did.
You know what? Honestly, like, I already had a bike. Do I need another bike? Or can I use that bike to do something good, right? So what I did was I reached out to a couple of my friends that are involved in the community. Chewy runs the Ookanicane Friendship Center. So I reached out to him, a couple other guys, Jimmy Slims from Slims Brand Barber here in town, and asked them what they thought I could do with this contest and what that chopper would be suited for. So I had this idea that if we could get through the contest, I could win. Then I could bring the chopper back here. We could auction it off. We could sell tickets on it. We could do whatever and donate that money to somebody. So overwhelmingly, they said to me, Discovery House. So Jimmy had gone through Discovery House. What it is, it's a men's addiction recovery house. Yep. They have many houses now. And so the idea was I approached Discovery House and said, here's what I'm involved in. How can we make this work for you guys to support you? Because I think what they do is great. They're a recovery center. They're not a wet facility. They have strict rules on recovery, and it's for men. And so I think we get a lot of funding and a lot of attention to organizations like that are focused on women. But
which is good.
Which is great.
Yeah.
But we don't do a lot for men. And so I thought, okay, well, these guys are privately funded. They don't get a lot of help from the government, and they're doing a great thing. So a dear friend of mine, who I'm building his bike right now in my shop, he went through that program. And so he also sits on the board. So he's a recovering addict. He sits on their board. And so they all said Discovery House. So I met with Jerome. I said, here's what I got going on. What can we do to use this? So it evolved into so much more than we ever thought it was going to. It really was a runaway train for about 2.5-3 months. But the idea was to try and win this chopper, get it back here, raffle it off, give them the money so that they had down payments for more facilities. So in the process of this whole thing, it just got so much attention. We were on the news. I did radio interviews. I mean, it just didn't end. And so daily we were doing updates. Daily I was doing videos. And our votes just kept piling up and piling up. And every time they'd reset us, we'd go straight back to first place. And so we had the community behind us. And then it was really defeating when we lost. Like, literally we lost in the semifinal. So we were going to be selected to be one of the four to go into the final to win. We literally lost in the last second. I was in first. The last second ticker came up. We went second and we lost. The voting was closed. And so it was very defeating. But, you know, I paced around my house and I wanted to call Jerome. And so I finally called Jerome, who runs Discovery House. And I said, Jerome, I apologize. We lost. You know, I'm defeated. And Jerome said the most amazing thing to me. He said, we didn't lose because the amount of attention that you brought Discovery House through social media, the news outlets, the community involvement. He said in the last 3 weeks, we have smashed our fundraising goals big time. And every time people call in, they say, we found out about you because of Daryl in that chopper contest.
Wow.
And so to me, that was a, I just felt like I just, this overwhelming pride that we had won, even though we'd lost.
Yeah.
And so since that contest, I believe Discovery House has bought in 3 more facilities.
I didn't know any of that.
Because Jerome said their traction was just incredible.
Yeah.
He was getting, he really tracks his website and what they do and where their, you know, their inquiries come from. Yeah. And he said their inquiries were coming from all over North America after we started this.
That's cool.
And so he said just the awareness we got. And so that people understood what we were about, that we weren't enabling these men. We were trying to get them to recover so they can go back to their families.
Yeah.
And so it just blew up. And so it was a great thing. So I actually, you know, parlayed that into a t-shirt that I call the Charity.
Hmm.
And $5 from every one of those t-shirts goes to Discovery House. So just before Christmas here, we'll be doing a presentation to Jerome for the first 100 t-shirts that we brought in. And we'll give them a check for $500 just to.
That's awesome.
So it just keeps me involved with those guys, but it keeps me involved in the community and it gives some purpose to what we do. It's not just me trying to pay for more shiny parts for my bike.
And it's worth mentioning too that because there are people who listen to this podcast who are looking for places to donate money to.
Certainly.
And to help out. Yep. So it's worth mentioning that if anybody wants to buy that t-shirt, it's available on Daryl's website,
yep,
which is sinisterspeedco.com.
Yep.
And yeah, you can just go right on there and buy it and he'll hand deliver the bitch to you.
Oh yeah. And they're you know what? They're badass t-shirts. They're black, but they're so comfy.
Yeah.
And they're, when it's 40 degrees outside, I wear it because it breathes so well. You don't even know you're wearing a t-shirt.
Yeah, and it's soft.
So soft.
It's not one of those cheap band tees that scratch your skin. It's nice. It's a nice tee.
Yeah. You know, we've really tried to just do the right things. Are you wearing yours?
I got mine on.
I'm wearing the long sleeve.
Yep.
I got my Charity and my hoodie on today.
Nice. Represent. Thanks,
Sarah. Representing Sinister. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, you know what? The involvement in you know, that I try and have in the community. You know, the flip side of that, too, was I did an interview with Castanet, and, you know, I made it very clear that the goal behind this, too, was to show people that bikers aren't dirtbags.
Yeah.
You know, we are involved in our communities. We support, you know, our brothers when they're in times of need. You know, a riding buddy who I consider a brother just lost his brother the other morning. And it kills me inside because he was so close to his brother, and I have a brother that I'm very close to. So it just killed me inside that he had lost his brother.
Yeah.
And so I reached out to him. He thanked me. You know, so we are supportive. And I think it's a good thing for, you know, these big, tough, badass, leather-toting bikers to check in with their brothers. You know, we have a great community here. And even when we hear that there's been an accident with a motorcycle on the highway or in town or whatever, instantly on Facebook, a check-in will go out. Motorcycle accident here, brothers check-in. And everybody will just say, I'm good, I'm good, I'm good. Yeah. And then it's a way for us to just reach out. And I think it's starting to get safer for men, you know, big, tough biker men, to start normalizing emotion, I guess, and checking in with our brothers and telling our brothers we love them.
Yeah.
I love that.
You know, it's
just the fact that you call them my brothers.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
that's so special.
You know, that's the neat thing about motorcycles, I think, is it's an instant brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
It's dangerous. It's
thrilling.
It's so freeing.
Yeah.
And so I think just having that instant bond with another person, I think that is totally different. And by using the term brother, I mean like the brotherhood with women too, because there's a lot of women that ride.
For sure.
And you're starting to see more and more women that ride, and you're starting to see more and more women that ride big bikes.
Yeah.
They're not just riding sportsters anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I've ridden with women this year that ride the exact same bike I do. It's a big, heavy beast. Mm-hmm. They handle it just like a champ.
That's
it's no
awesome.
Big deal to them. There's no barrier there. And that's, I think that's the other cool thing about something like that. And this whole, you know, community is there's no barriers there.
Yeah.
You know, I've ridden with the Sikh Riders of Canada. They organized mm-hmm. a ride to the Kamloops school. The very first ride that went up there, they organized it out of the Lower Mainland. I piggybacked it out of Penticton. We met them in Merritt.
Yeah.
And I still get messages from those guys. And that's exactly what they yeah. say to me is they call us brothers. Like,
yeah.
there's no color barrier. There's no, you know.
Cause, awesome. And because you guys did organized, or you, I guess, most more specifically, organized the Every Child Matters bike rally. At least for this area.
Well, I piggybacked their ride.
Got it.
And we met them in Merritt. So they organized the ride itself. I just rallied up, you know, whatever we took out of here. There was, must have been 15 or 20 of us or something.
Yeah. I've seen your guys' yeah. videos. That was pretty impressive.
It was.
Yeah. yeah. And you know what? There again, you know, I've got friends that are Indigenous and, you know, that whole thing. I saw what that did to them and how it affected them. And so it just keeps drawing you into your community. And I think if you don't feel something for those situations, you don't have a heart.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. And it's yeah. like you said, it's the talents you have and the skills and the opportunity that you mm-hmm. have. And you're not letting that go to waste. You're using it.
Well, it was easy to rally those guys up because of my social media, and I don't have a massive social media presence, but the presence I do have, I use it when we need those events to be done quickly. We did that in less than 24 hours.
Yeah.
And we must have had 50 people that saw us off, and away we went. You know, they saw us out of there. So, I mean, you know, the second rally up there to Kamloops was certainly much bigger. We had people lining the highways yes. all the way to Peachland.
That's amazing.
So, I mean, and even through West Kelowna, when we went through West Kelowna,
it must feel so good to just ride your bike for good, when you're doing it for, even not doing it for a good cause, but when you're doing it for a good cause and you've got people yep. lined up for yep. kilometers mm-hmm. along the highway yep. to support you.
Yeah.
God, that must feel good.
I've never cried so much. Those two rides were emotions from pure joy to mm-hmm. devastation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I mean, it, you know, it's great that we can use, you know, my side hustle.
Yeah.
To do community events like that, you know, really help. We'll do more this year now with COVID stuff starting to kind of back off. We can certainly do a lot more events. So
I'm so excited for you.
This year's yeah. going to be good. 2022, I think, is going to be a way cooler year. I think we're going to do more.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, we're going to do more and larger stuff, I think, that's, you know, a good impact for the community.
Yeah. I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
Me too.
I've talked long enough.
No, this is it's very eye-opening to see how you can use your side hustle to actually just make a better quality of life for yourself and for those around you.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And what an important lesson for everybody who gets to hear, who has the pleasure of listening to this podcast, to take away that your side hustle doesn't just have to be income generating.
Yeah.
No.
But it can be used for good.
Yep. 100%. Yeah. Yep. And I, you know what, honestly, I think that, you know, with the community involvement we have here in Penticton from a lot of big businesses, small businesses, when there's a need in our community, they mm-hmm. step up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And your side hustle should be no different. I think that you can utilize your benefits to, you know, help other people.
Yeah.
Yeah. 100%.
Show some selflessness. I mean, you know, being selfless is hard thing to find these days.
It's so true, but I've lived in a couple different places. Penticton is so strong this way.
Yeah.
Like, they are so community driven that you like can't help but get on that bandwagon and be like mm-hmm. and then when you start actually practicing, it's like something like the disaster that happened in Princeton, mm-hmm. you feel compelled to do something, to yeah. take action, because you're like,
you don't even think about it. It's automatic.
That's yeah. right.
I have 100%. To go and do that right now.
Yes.
You know, yeah. and that's I you know, I did it.
That's
I set aside a day And we just loaded up and blasted down there. Yeah. And
you were one of the first, the first people there.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
To deliver stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, we were. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, the food bank didn't even, they had had nobody come in there yet. And when we walked in there, they're like, why are you here? And they're like, we have stuff for you. And they were like, what? They couldn't believe it.
That's amazing.
Yeah. They were beside themselves because nobody had come to help them yet. Yeah. And, but. You know, we just, I like for me, I don't even think about it. It's just,
it's in your DNA.
There's people that need us. I have a brother there, like, you know, Chewy, that's where he lives. Yeah. I mean, they were just about flooded right out. Yeah. And so I had to get there. I had to go there. I had to hug him. I had to make sure that he knew. And I did not expect at the gala for him to mention that.
Right.
Yeah, that was
too. And get that emotional.
Oh my gosh.
I was choking on
I think we all
emotion so, yeah. because
what Daryl's yeah. talking about is we recently had an event that we were at, and Chewy, who runs the Ukanane Friendship Center here in Penticton, lives in Princeton. There are massive natural disasters in Princeton right now with rainfall and floods and mudslides. Chewy was affected and was also the MC of this particular event at the same time that his house was being affected, and not only his house but his entire community. And he came anyways, despite what was going on in his life. He committed to coming to this event, to speaking in front of everybody as our MC for the evening, and got very choked up during his speech, resulting in pretty sure there was no dry eye in the whole house.
No. And the call to action, too, was huge. Like, my hubby was sitting right beside me, and we've done a few runs out to Princeton to drop off product. But, like, both of us looked at each other, and I was like, I don't want to be here anymore. It's not because it's not a beautiful event. It's because, well, I'm sitting here, there's a level of guilt where I feel we should be loading up the product that we have and delivering it out there. It was like that motivation, the call to help out. And my hubby, who's a very, like, you know, he's not the first guy to get emotional in a situation, was sitting there like trying to keep it together.
Oh, yeah.
And he was like, I'm like, you don't have to keep it together, but I get it. Like, it's just, he felt exactly what Chewy was saying.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And I think that for a guy like Chewy to get that emotional and, you know, express himself like that is pretty rare.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see how that impacted him. He was just so grateful that people wanted to help them.
Yeah.
You know, and it, you know what? Yeah, it'd be easy to sit there and brag, oh, I went out to Princeton. No. But it, really, at the end of the day, it's not about that. It's not. I didn't publicize it. We just went and did it. It was done.
But I do have to say, you were with people that made note of it. And that is super important, because that awareness, people didn't know. And because of your guys' response, and because of what we were posting on all the social medias and JCI, frick, the community of Penticton and Summerland, they were so giving. I have to tell you, we did like 4 loads out there to Princeton. We did 1 out to Merritt. Like, the response was crazy because of what you guys did. And that public awareness is not a bad thing. It is super positive. And people that are like, you know, you shouldn't be posting these things, I'm like, fuck that. Yes, you should, because people don't know what they don't know.
And people need to understand that you're only getting a small snippet of what's going on out there.
Right.
And there was so much more to what was going on out there. Yeah. Like, what their community was doing to clean up was just incredible to see.
Yeah.
You know, their mayor
is
just a pillar there. I mean, as soon as the flood started, he was 72 hours without a sleep. He went from directing traffic to putting up traffic cones to feeding people to doing a video to support the young people in their community and say, hey, you know what? We're here. We're trying to get your school, get you back to school, get you back to normal. Like, he was 72 hours without sleep because he was what everybody should be.
Yeah.
A leader.
Don't talk about it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Lead by your actions and get out there.
Yeah.
How old is
Justin
this?
Trudeau? Take a look at what he was doing.
Whoa,
Spencer.
Oh, snap.
Shots fired.
I'll call people out all day. I don't care. But, like, if you can't be, there's a big difference. You know, people call themselves leaders, but
until you're
leaders are
down on the ground.
These leaders are easy to spot.
That's right.
And it's easy for people to say they're a leader, but you show you're a leader and then I'll believe you. You know, it's
And he was firmly in with his community. 100%. You could see. And the community response. Like,
because
I started
he has a
crying.
Job to do.
Yeah, but I started crying leaving because you could see all the community down in that bowl where there was 100%. Like thick mud and they were everybody
cleaning
was helping everybody.
100%.
And I was just like, that response is crazy. Like,
and I think that that's why we were compelled to go there, because they couldn't leave because they were busy cleaning. Like, to make a trip to Walmart today to go get Christmas gifts and stuff for the kids is not a priority.
Yeah.
Cleaning the city up and getting the water turned back on and the power turned back on was a priority.
Yeah.
And so they weren't leaving. So we'll come to you. We'll bring you stuff. I mean, we had so many donations here in Penticton that the food bank and the city of Princeton asked us to stop
bringing stuff. I remember. Yeah. They were like, please stop.
I'm they're like, and so we've got warehouses of stuff here that we will use.
Yes.
But I mean, they asked to stop because they were just overwhelmed by how much was coming in there and they had nowhere to put it.
Yeah. And then even
and they
locally,
didn't need it at that point. There was so much had gone there. They were full and they were good.
But the response was just, I said repeatedly over and over again, I was like, it is crazy to me how, like, if everybody just gave a little bit, everybody would have enough.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. And it was just that response was just to see people giving everything and anything they could.
Yeah.
It was absolutely amazing.
I still have stuff sitting in the corner here that there's a gas tank full of gas. There's a couple space heaters and they can't really use them.
Well, So basically at this point, I started calling around to different food banks and seeing like, okay, who needs help? And one of the things I didn't expect is Penticton said, well, our numbers have almost doubled because we're not sure if they're coming from Princeton or people coming in from surrounding areas that can't live in those areas. We need help here too. Cause I called Kelowna too. And they're like, please check in with, you know, your local area. And I'm like, 100%. I just naturally presume they're fine. Cause they do an annual food drive and everything like that. Yeah. They're like, the lady at the gate explained to me how they break down their food and how long it lasts. And I didn't realize that they go through it like rapid fire.
Oh, yeah.
So I was like, hell yeah. So I went there with a couple of loads, loaded them up. And even now I just went back yesterday and they're like, yeah, any food donations you have, we're more than happy. And I look at their stockhouse and I'm like, you don't realize how fast the food bank goes through stuff.
Yeah.
So if anybody around this season
have a lot
donate,
of need
it's
here.
Crazy.
Sure.
But it's nice to know that. You know, I know that Abbotsford and Merritt are still dealing with a horrendous situation. And even Princeton, they're constantly watching their water levels. But around this season, if I can throw it out there, it's just, you know, follow the examples of the people around you and give a little bit so that everybody can have enough.
Yeah.
So
it's like the old term, follow the leader.
That's right. Daryl's the leader, so follow him.
I don't know about that.
There we go.
But I do my part.
Yeah. Well, you do a lot. So for all of us who are, you know, looking for examples, you're definitely one to follow.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Speaking of following,
Mm-hmm.
do you want to wrap this up by telling us, well, a couple things.
Yeah.
Book recommendation. I know you've been itching. Here comes the time where Shay pulls her phone out to put
I'm
it in
sorry,
her
but
cart.
You should see my last order. It was like, I was like, here's my here's my Christmas present to myself.
Yeah. So I got a book last year. I'm still not done reading it, but I was sitting at my computer one day and this short video came on of a guy named David Goggins.
Love David Goggins. Sometimes I stare at those shoes for an hour before I go out, motherfucker.
So he is an incredible individual that has gone through some horrifying life experiences that no one should ever go through. And his book, Can't Hurt Me, is basically a story about finding strength in yourself. But it's so alarming. If you think you've got a bad life or you had a bad childhood, read that book and you're going to think that you grew up in the royal house because he persevered through some horrifying things. And he is just such an accomplished man. He's not everybody's cup of tea. He is very blunt. He is very outspoken.
Intense.
Very intense. But the book is just such an incredible read. And, you know, I like I say, I'm not through the book yet just because summer got away from me and stuff. So I'll finish the book this winter. But it's a good read. You can find lots in it. I mean, there's a lot of lessons in that book. I'm not really into self-help books, so I struggle with his his kind of little self-help things at the end of the chapters, but the story itself I draw so much from. So incredible book. I quite like it.
Yeah.
That's, he's a very good friend of Joe Rogan's. Mm-hmm. And so Joe Rogan is constantly talking about, you know, things that David Goggins will text him or call him and leave a voicemail or whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's...
Well, and for anybody out there listening to this that thinks they're badass, you might be badass, but you are not David Goggins trying to get through SEAL training with broken bones badass.
Right,
yeah.
That guy is a beast. And he overcame some fears that are just... They just would grip him so tightly. Couldn't swim.
He run like a marathon a day. Like to this day, he runs like a marathon every morning.
I don't know if he does.
Well, he was. Maybe he isn't currently, but he was doing that for quite a while.
Yeah, he is like full on beast mode. Like he is turned on 100% from the second he wakes up till he goes to bed.
Yeah.
So I just have to point this out. So I read the book American Sniper by Jim.
I've got it sitting at home. Yes. It's my next book.
Yeah. So it's a good read.
Yeah.
But he actually makes a comment on this book by David Goggins. He said, "By the time you finish David Goggins' new book, you'll have kicked your victim mentality in the butt.
Yep.
As the man with a hole in his heart tells you, there are no excuses in life, only reasons to try harder."
Yep.
I love it.
They claim, they introduce him as the toughest man on earth.
Wow.
And
that's quite the title.
He is the only guy on the planet to ever finish SEAL training, Army Ranger training, and another one.
Yeah. Oh, and they're Air Force tactical.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So they're all basically the same as SEAL training.
Wow.
And he is the only guy to do all three.
God, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Just an absolute beast of a man. So, and I mean, everybody thinks they're a victim. You know, we live in an entitled world, and he's going to snap you out of that if you read that book.
That's amazing. It's in the bucket. Yeah. Got it? It's
another book I have. So I have American Sniper I'm going to read next.
Yeah, it's good.
There's also another book called Save Me From Myself. Mm-hmm. And it is written by the guy from Korn. Oh, his name is escaping me right now.
Oh, I should know this too. I keep thinking of Trent Reznor and that story.
Ryan Welch?
No. Yeah, Head Welch.
Yeah. Yeah,
so it's Head's book, and I tried to listen to it on whatever.
Audible?
Audible book, and I lost it and never bought it again. So I've got it at home. I'm also going to read that. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
These are good books.
Yeah.
Good books. Yeah.
Dee, tell people where they can find you.
Well, you know what? We're on the Facebook.
Facebook.
I'm also on Instagram at I believe I am sinister_speed_co, and we're also at www.sinisterspeedco.com.
Heck yes, you are.
Yeah.
I've said this to you before, and I'm going to say it again for everybody to hear. I'm truly blessed to have you as a friend, to be able to call you a friend. That's a privilege to me.
Well, thank you, sir.
You're an incredible human, and I'm so glad you were able to come and give people just a tiny snippet of what you do every day.
Yeah, no, that's...
This community would not be the same without you, and I know that all of our kind of circle of friends are very appreciative of what you do, not only for your friends, but for everybody, and you're very selfless in that way, and thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for those kind words. Yeah. I also appreciate all those people in my life. And I think that, you know, good or bad, there's always something to appreciate in everybody. So you just got to dig and find it.
Yeah.
And some people it's a little harder to find.
But they're somewhere.
It's always there.
Yeah.
There's a good person in there somewhere. They just may not show it.
Yeah. That's trauma, baby.
Yeah, it is. There's lots of that around.
That's true. Well, Daryl, it has been a pleasure.
Well, thank you.
And for all of our listeners, remember, stay hip.